Good afternoon. So last time we finished covering our move CPU, mentioning how we this general idea that when we're building our CPU, we have these built-in components where we need to have the values we want to write set up, and when we want to read something, we need to have the addresses or register numbers we want to read. And we wire up connections to make that happen for each instruction. And when we have this sort of conflict where one instruction wants to do one thing, like one instruction wants to write register A, and another instruction wants to do another, like not write anything, we add a mux to let us choose between those two options. And that let us sort of build things incrementally, where we added one instruction at a time, adding muxes as we needed them, and each of the muxes would be controlled by basically a function of our opcode. Then we talked about our actual hardware description language. And the basic idea here is we had ways of defining new components we needed, like registers. And otherwise, we were just connecting wires together, that we had wires which were either from built-in components or from things we defined, like a PC register. And we put them together, and when we wanted a mux, we had this sort of case expression syntax, which is sort of like a switch statement. We have this special thing where the cases were evaluated in order, which ends up being convenient later on when we do pipelining, which we'll talk about possibly Thursday a little bit. And that's sort of how we actually made our decisions in HCLRS. So I'd like to talk a bit more systematically. So last time we talked about register banks, and we started talking about wires, which is the general idea for anything we can connect to something else, has a value, or can have a value be set. And what HCLRS calls a wire is anything which can accept or produce a signal. And some of these are implicit. So we saw I10 bytes, that was the output of our instruction memory. That's a wire, it has a signal every cycle, there's a value that has, and it's set not by us, but by a built-in component. But we can also define our own wires, in which case we would obviously need to set them because nothing built-in is going to do that for us. And we can also use the value on that wire multiple times to choose the value for other wires, what is connected. And key point of confusion is that our assignment operator is connecting wires, that when we assign two wires together, what we mean is that in the hypothetical CPU we're building, that there's some physical connection of the value we're producing on the right-hand side to the left-hand side wire is physically connected to that, which means it doesn't matter what order things happen in. In our file, the order is going to be determined by, well, either valp has a value it's being set to every cycle, or it doesn't. In every cycle, our simulator is going to go through, and it's going to say, OK, I need to set little p valp c to valp, and it's going to figure out, okay, that means I need to figure out what valp is first. And it's going to do that regardless of where valp is in the file. It's going to do them in the order that needs to happen, and it's going to all happen every cycle. Every cycle we get a new value for our registers, and that cascades to give us a new value for every single wire. Potentially, the new value is equal to the old value, but it's computed anew every cycle. So the order doesn't matter. Either valp has a value that it's set to, or it doesn't. So any questions about this concept? And just every cycle we're going to propagate from newly set registers all the way through to the various inputs we have for things like registers and other built-in components that do writes. The other notable thing about wires we mentioned is that they have widths. So we have, when we declare a wire, we declare it with a width, and all the built-in wires, so like I10 bytes is 80 bits wide. All of them have a width, and when you assign values, they need to agree in width. That you can't take a big wire and assign it to a small one, or vice versa. Like, we could have done something like, say, all the bits you're not assigning become zero, or any extra bits you assign go away. We decided not to do that. Instead, it's an error. Because usually, if you're trying to do this, you made a mistake. Like a logical error that you want to fix. If you need to be explicit, you can like take a big value and subset its bits explicitly to do that assignment. And there's also a syntax that's in the HCLRS write-up that's linked off the website. There's a link at the top, HCLRS, which tells you how to add bits to a wire, though I've never seen anyone ever do that for any assignment. But it exists. So I mentioned that wires have widths. And HCLRS makes this kind of weird compromise that not all values have widths. So constants like 10 or a hexadecimal constant don't have a width, mostly because if they did, we'd need a way of specifying like a 13-bit value, because that's not, you know, we just have a way of specifying the width external to the constant, and that would be kind of awkward. So we just didn't do it. We just don't enforce the width. And if you're assigning a constant which is too big, we'll just truncate it. If it's too small, we'll add zeros as appropriate for decimal and hexadecimal constants. For binary constants, for which the syntax is 0b and the bits, those have a width, and we will enforce that strictly. If you have a 4-bit binary constant like this, and you assign it to a 3-bit wire, that's an error. You assign it to a 5-bit wire, that's an error. You need to assign it to exactly a 4-bit wire. Also, most of the built-in constants. So like we saw stat-aok, that's just a constant. We saw nop, that's a constant for the instruction code of nop. Those all have widths. So if you like take a nop and try to put it on an 8-bit value, you'll get an error because nop is a 4-bit constant, because that's the width of the opcode field at the beginning of the instruction. So any questions about this? Constant widths, and generally that widths need to agree. Okay, so let's talk more systematically about built-in components. So we saw the stack register and the instruction memory. I'll just go through these quickly since we saw them, and then I'll go through the register file, which we haven't seen any examples of, but we have a built-in register file. Remember when you saw that output with the values of REX, RBX, RCX? We provide a register file for you, and you must use it, because how it would be very, very hard to grade your processors if we couldn't figure out what values were in registers. And also, it's going to save you a lot of time. You could like write your own register file with the register bank stuff, but that would be very annoying. You like have to like say, if RA is zero, then write register RAX and so on. You have to write all that logic yourself. You don't have to do that, because we provide a register file that already implements, you know, all that logic and looking at register numbers and so on. So let's talk first about the stat register. So we saw this. This is how do we stop the machine? Determines if the simulator keeps going. In real hardware, when you want to shut down the machine, something more complicated is probably going on, because like you want to turn off power, actually. But this is our sort of simpler simulation of that. And there's a whole bunch of possible values. If you want to see the list, in the HCLRS write-up, we have like all the constants that are defined, and you can see the various other constants, but you probably won't use any of the others, because we don't care about that part of the processor. So one is AOK, you've seen, that's keep going. And then we have a bunch of codes which are don't keep going. One is halt, which is stop normal shutdown. So our simulator says you halted, nothing went wrong, you're just done. What you do for the halt instruction. And we also have notably invalid instruction. The difference between that and halt is when the simulator stops, instead of saying you halted, it's going to say invalid instruction and say that something bad happened. Also have the instruction memory, and as you saw before, it has an input wire, which is always called PC. So every clock cycle, It looks for what value PC gets set to during that clock cycle. And during the same cycle, it sets i10 bytes to the value in memory at that address. And it always reads 10 bytes from memory. If you have an instruction that's only one byte, well, too bad, you're reading 10 bytes. You better just not use all of the bytes. But you're reading 10 bytes, that's all you can do. So just don't use the extra bits for those other instructions, but you have to read 10 bytes. There's no way to not read 10 bytes. So you also have the register file. And the register file works like the one we've seen in pictures. We have inputs, which are numbers of registers to access. So these 4-bit numbers, which identify a register between 0 and 14. And we also have register number 15, which is reserved for don't do anything, the don't read, don't write. And these have specific names that are hard-coded. So source A is the register number input that corresponds to output A. So if you want to read from register RAX, you put the register number for RAX in source A, and you get out the value of RAX in reg output A during the same cycle. And the same works with source B and output B. We also have our destinations, which are M and E, so reg dest M. If you want to write to a specific register before the end of the clock cycle, you put the number of that register you want to write in dest M, and the value you want to write in input M, and by the end, at the end of the cycle, we'll look at those values and store it in the register that you specify. And if you want to write to dest E, you can put it in input E. You put the value in, you set the, put the register number in dest D and the value into write and input. So any questions about these? Yes?
Is there a difference between source A and source B?
Is there a difference between source A and source B? Is one of them special? They both act the same way, they just have different names because you need to read two registers at once. Same with dest D and dest M, they both act the same way, with the minor exception of what happens if you specify the same register number for both, in which case one of them has been arbitrarily chosen to win, and it's the same one every time. But otherwise, they both act the same way. They're just two of them are there because sometimes we need to read two registers, like an add instruction, and sometimes we need to write two registers, like a pop instruction. A notable feature about these signals is that if you don't supply a value for dest M or dest D, you see we didn't do that before. You might say, what happens? Well, there's a sensible default. If you don't supply a dest M value, we just don't write all the time. It's just so you have less boilerplate. Yes?
From the textbook, the port M, such as input M is for memory, and for input E is for ALU.
Okay. Yes, so you're saying in the textbook, they say input E is always the ALU, input M is always memory. And in the simulator the textbook was written for, it was less flexible than ours is. So there, like, memory was hardwired to input M, basically. And we don't do that. You can use what either you want, but the names are intended for E for execute for ALU and M for memory. Is why the names are that way and how the textbook intends them to be used. But we, HTLRS doesn't enforce that you do that.
So when we are solving the queries, we have to base our knowledge on the textbook or the...
So the question is, in the quizzes, when we ask you about dest M and dest D, it's correct to do either. As long as, because they still both write. So if we're asking you, like, which one is right, well, it doesn't matter which you use, you still have a correct processor. So you should answer that, like, it doesn't matter whether we're using dest D or dest M. As long as, you know, we're writing the same values to the same register numbers. Yes.
So we're not going to do any kind of conventions as soon as either?
So the question is, we're not going to do any kind of conventions? I would strongly recommend following the textbook's convention, but when we grade your assignments, we're not going to care. You do what makes sense for you. Okay, other questions? So let's do a simple example by constructing a CPU that does ads. So I have a PC register, and I have a bunch of named wires just for decoding the instruction. So I'm going to have RA, RB, iCode, and iFunc. I'm going to extract both of them from the instruction. And also, I'm going to have my PC update happen, where every cycle, the PC is equal to the output of the register. That is, so we read from the current PC location, and we set the next PC location to increment by 2, which is the size of an add instruction. So I get my iCode and my iFunc, which I'm actually going to ignore in this example because I haven't handled anything but ads yet. But I also get RA and RB, the register numbers from the instruction. And I put RA in source A so I can read from source A. And that means that register A's value ends up being in reg output A. I put RB in source B, so register B's value ends up being in output B. And I can just write a C-like arithmetic expression to add them together. And HCLRS will figure out like how to simulate that. And you know, if we had a tool that was compiling to hardware, it'd figure out how to put an adder there. And maybe we have some way of specifying what kind. But we do this sum, and we set that, connect that sum, the result of that addition, to input E, the new value we want to write. But we also need to specify where do we write that. So we write it to register RB, and we do that by setting DESTY, the corresponding destination register number, to be equal to that. So any questions on what's going on in this add processor? So this is a processor that implements adds, where adds are formatted like in YAD6. Yes?
So that works like we automatically giving us an adder there.
Yes, questions. When you use plus, it gives us an adder there? Yes. And the idea is that we're in this class, we're not concerned with how do you implement adders, multipliers, anders, and so on. We're just going to provide them to you sort of built in. If you were building a real processor, you'd have to maybe do some extra stuff to specify the details of that adder that we aren't concerned about in this class. Yeah.
Why is the iCode not the first 4 bytes?
So when we have our instruction, bits 0 through 8 are the first byte, and bits 8 through 16 are the second byte. But within each byte, bit 0 is the least significant. And in our table, we wrote the values of the first byte as opcode and then the function code. And this is the least significant part of the byte. And yes, this case is kind of unintuitive with the table of instructions we've seen. But to make it work out intuitively, we need to like draw the table backwards, which we could have done. Like, so one is on the, so the byte 1 and 0 are on the right-hand side. Right-hand side. Other questions? Okay, and so this is sort of what we ended up doing. It's connected RA to source A, RB to source B, RB to dest B, E, and the sum. And we also, you know, didn't specify some values. Like, we didn't specify this dest M. HCLRS will infer that if you don't specify it, well, you choose a sensible default of, in this case, you know, 15, we won't write anything. And Because this is has the default value, we won't care that you didn't specify reg input n. We'll give it a sensible default. Any questions about this? So the last component we need is our data memory. So this is for RM move Q, MR move Q, and push and pop. So these are instructions which access memory in addition to reading the instruction. So every instruction accesses memory because it has to read the instruction to figure out what to do. But these instructions also access memory to move data around and use the data memory. And the data memory has inputs we've discussed sort of more abstractly, just telling you what their names in HTLRS is. So it has an address, which is either the address to read or write, depending on whether we're doing a read or write. It has an input value, and it has an output value. So if we're reading, then we're going to use the address and the output value only. If we're writing, we're going to use the input and the address only. And you should not read and write at the same time. Yes? You should not read and write at the same time, one or the other. And the way you control which you do is if you want to read, you set memread bits, which is a 1-bit wire, to 1. And if you want to write, you set memwrite bit to 1. So for example, if I want to read, I set the address, I set read bit to 1, I set write bit to 0, and the output is set in the same cycle, just like the instruction memory. Sometime during the cycle, when the address is available, we'll get the output set to the value at memory at that value. And if we want to write, we set the address, we set the input, and we set write bit to 1, read bit to 0, and we will write in the end of the cycle. So we set the values during the cycle, and at the very end of the cycle, whatever those values are, will be written, but not beforehand. So something I'd like to note about data memory and the instruction memory is the way we've drawn things, it looks like these are two independent things, that we load a program and we have some separate memory for the data, and that MR move Q, RM move Q don't access that. This is not how our memories work. Both of these memories magically access the same actual data. So whatever values at address 10 in the data memory is the same value that's at address 10 in the instruction memory. So you can read instructions from the data memory. You can write instructions to the data memory and later read them from the instruction memory and execute them. It's all one big memory. It's just like these are two interfaces to the same memory. Later on, when we talk about caches, we'll talk about what really happens, kind of. That, you know, that might make this work, but for now, this is sort of just magic, that they're both the same memory, even though they have these separate, even though we're drawing them as separate components. So any questions about our data memory? So one thing I mentioned some differences from the book. So one of them was that like we have input M and input E that you can use for whatever, even though they're intended for memory and the ALU. Another choice that I think I alluded to last time was that in the textbook they sort of had a built-in ALU. We don't have one, but since we let you like write addition instructions, you can implement one. You know, pretty straightforwardly, and we're at a high enough level of abstraction that we're not concerned with how the add and subtract actually work and how you actually make that efficient. If you're like an actual digital logic person, you might not like this abstraction for defining an ALU, because you might say, oh, those should share most of the circuit. But we're not doing that. We're not worried about that. So you could do something like this. And there are other choices that come up. So for example, in the textbook, sometimes we need to add or subtract 8 from RSP. In the textbook, they always use the ALU, like one place that does that. That's the same as all additions. We don't care. If you want to have some dedicated plus 8 circuit conceptually, that's fine. No, we're not going to stop you. Well, the requirements are that you execute one instruction a cycle for the first processor we're building. So we don't want any instructions to like take an extra cycle. And this includes things like push or pop, where you might think, oh, these do two things. Sorry, has to take one cycle. And you have to use the supplied registers and memory, register file and memory, so we can figure out what your processor is doing. Otherwise, we just care that you make it function correctly within those parameters. So any questions about these requirements or non-requirements? Okay. So in HDLS, we saw that basic structure was we assigned two wires. We can build muxes where we have condition, value, a list of them, which are evaluated as if in order. We could define our own registers, which right now we're only doing for the PC and the condition codes, but later on we'll have a lot more registers we want to define. And we have this fixed functionality. So we had a built-in register file with our 15 registers, so we didn't need to build that something like to take source A and figure out what the value of the appropriate register was. It's already built for us, and you in fact have to use it. We also had built-in memory, so data and instruction memory, which in fact are interfaces to the same actual memory, and a stat register, which is how we control our simulation of the processor to let it know when to stop, so you can figure out, did it do the right thing and finish or not. So any questions about HCLRS, which I would note you are using in lab tomorrow, and also for homework for next week? Okay, so let's go back to our move CPU and a topic in the textbook, which we kind of glossed over. So our textbook talks a lot about stages. Like it divides the instructions into pieces and tells you that each piece does something different. And let's take our move CPU and let's mark the stages our textbook talks about. The way I'm drawing things doesn't really seem like the most rational division of things. We'll find out later on when we talk about pipelining the real reason the textbook authors chose these stages. But we have our fetch stage, where we read the instruction memory and also compute the length and use that. We have our decode stage, where we read registers. You would think the decode stage would be where we interpret the iCode. That isn't the case. It's just bad naming. That unfortunately is common in the literature. We have our execute stage, where we do whatever we're doing with the ALU, or equivalent. We have our memory stage, where we do whatever we're doing with the data memory. If we aren't doing anything with the data memory, well, there's nothing in this stage that's relevant. And we have our write back stage, where we actually send values to the register file. Note that the write-back stage is not where we write to the data memory. That happens in the memory stage. That's kind of confusing. Write-back is write to registers. Reading or writing from memory is in the memory stage. So these are our stages. Any question about these stages? And this is how a way our textbook divides up instructions, partly because it's going to help us later, and partly to help you think about what instructions do more systematically, which is helpful when we have these complicated instructions like push and pop. Push does a whole lot of stuff, pop does a whole lot of stuff, more than any instruction we've seen, and it's nice to work on it in pieces, and the textbook's idea is that these stages will help you do that. And that's the purpose of this division. It's a conceptual division of the instruction into pieces. So when we're building our processor, we can just worry about the components in each of these boxes. Okay, so any questions about the stages? Okay. So let's talk about how these stages relate to time. So we have push Q REX. At some point, this reads the push instruction. At some point, it changes memory to push the REX value into memory. At some point, it changes the stack pointer to actually move it to its new location, move it down. And at some point, it changes the PC so we can be ready to execute the next instruction. So using your knowledge of how registers, register files, and memory work, well, we mentioned, went through all the timing and so on. Using that knowledge, figure out what the order these things happen in is. We have a whole bunch of options. Check with your neighbor to see if you agree. So who needs more time? Go on. Okay, so who thinks it's A? B. Okay, a couple people. C. D. Okay. E. Okay. F. Okay, so answers are all over the place. And this hint here is really important. So if you remember when we talked about all these components, we had a rising edge of the clock, and then another rising edge of the clock, and all reading happened in here, and all writing was triggered by the rising edge of the clock. And this is a conceptual division of the instruction. And you really want it to affect when things happen. But it's just a way of like dividing up the processor into pieces so we can work on them independently. What determines the order things happen in is how the components work physically and the clock signal they're getting. So even though you really want, like, our textbooks giving these stages, and they're in a particular order, and they always part them in that order, but it doesn't actually change what the hardware does. Like, just because we have write back after memory, it's still going to be the case that we have a value sitting here and a value sitting here at the same time as we have a value sitting here and here, and that causes a write at the same rising edge of the clock. So it's just a conceptual division. At this point, it's just helping you organize the pieces of the processor, maybe, so you cannot, like, think about the entire thing when you're figuring out how to implement this instruction. So another thing many people may have been thinking is, gosh, push, the way that works is we write to memory, we decrement the stack pointer, and then we write to memory. Right? Because you think, I need to know the new stack pointer and then write. If you remember, which is tricky to remember exactly how push works, like, push writes to the stack below the stack pointer. You'd say, well, that means we write to the stack pointer, update it first, and then we write to memory there. And that's usually how we've written it down. We said that push does RSP becomes RSP minus 8, and then memory at RSP becomes RAX. This is how we've written sort of what how it works, but we can't actually implement it this way in our single cycle processor, because there's no way we can write RSP before we update memory. To do that, we would have to use more than one clock cycle, and we are not doing that. We're doing everything in one clock cycle. So that means what we're going to end up doing instead is that we're going to do two things at once, is that we're going to simultaneously set RSP to RSP minus 8 and write to memory at RSP minus 8 RAX. This is at the same time. And that's how we have to implement the instruction, even though you probably really find it easier to think about if we could just update RSP and then use that updated value. But because we only have one cycle, we can't do that. Yes?
So is the point that, like, once the rising clock edge comes to that value, you're already on this wire, so it doesn't
really matter? So, yeah, so when the rising clock edge comes, we're going to do both of these at the same time. We'll have the right the new value on the wires, and we'll also have our write to memory set up so it has the right address, which is also that new value. Yeah, they'll all already be set, but they'll have to be set in one cycle. We can't write the value and read back the new value from the register file. We have to get it from somewhere else. So, any questions on this timing issue? Yes? So which one's the right answer? The right answer is B, because this is a read. So this goes in this reading part, and these are all writes. Any other questions? Question is, would pop have the memory be read before everything else? So if we had pop, memory would be read before anything is written, but it would have to be the case that data memory is read after the instruction memory is read, because otherwise we couldn't figure out where to read from. And that would be sometime in that big reading period. So near the beginning, we'd read the instruction memory. Sometime later, we'd read the data memory, using the information we got from the instruction memory to figure out how to do that. Other questions? Okay. So stages are not useful for figuring out what order things actually happen in. You have to actually think about, how does the register file work? How does the memory work to do that? they are useful for helping us figure out what instructions do, and our textbook gives many instruction listings in this sort of systematic format where you write down the operations that belong to each stage separately, and this lets us sort of build a processor piece by piece, that we just worry about the part before the register file for the code, and then we just worry about the part before the data memory for the memory stage, and we don't have to think about the whole thing all at once every time for every instruction. We can just worry about the beginning pieces, these first couple, like, we can just worry about the fetch and decode boxes before we move on to, say, the memory and write back boxes. And in doing this, we have instruction listings which are this, which look like this, and this format's kind of opaque, so I'm gonna go over what the heck does the textbook mean when they're writing this notation. So first, we have M1 of PC, and this means read one byte from memory. So this is read one byte from memory. And because we're in the fetch stage, this has to be from the instruction memory. That's the only memory that's in the fetch stage box. And since we only want one byte and the instruction memory gives us 10, this means we're just taking a subset of the wires in the instruction memory and using that to get, or in this case, our iCode and iFun. And the textbook is saying this is the name that they're giving to the wire. And if you want to use the same name in HTLRS, you are welcome to do so. If you don't, because some of the names are pretty bad, you don't have to. And the assignment just means connecting the wire, so the iCode is a name for those output bits of the instruction memory that are that part of the output. Now, some assignments don't actually do that. So for example, in the PC update stage, they have this assignment to PC. And what they really mean there is putting a value on the input wire to the PC register, so at the rising edge of the clock, the PC will change. So any questions on what we've seen so far? Yes. So this is saying that we're going to take one byte from the instruction memory and name half iCode and half iFun. So it's just giving an alias for part of the output of the instruction memory, which we could use later. In this case, we apparently aren't, because NOP is a pretty boring instruction. And also other things we'll talk about in a bit. So let's look at NOP and jump. So remember our NOP jump CPU? This is the description the textbook gives. So we have our same get the iCode and iFun from the program counter, and we have two different, a computation of valP and a computation of what's called valC. Note that we're getting a different set of bits from the instruction memory output. In this case, we're getting 8 through 72, starting one byte in, getting 8 bytes out. So 8 bytes, but starting at not byte 0, but byte 1. And we're calling that valC. And in the PC update stage, we have a conflict. One of these wants to set the input to the PC register to valP. One of them wants to set it to valP, and what that means is that when we build a processor that does both of these, we have a mux. And our mux is going to choose valP if the iCode is for NOP, and it's going to choose, valC if the iCode is for jump. So that tells us to add a mux, and this mux has an input which is based on the iCode. And we don't write in that it's based on the iCode and these listings of instructions. That's kind of implied, that there's a bunch of muxes anytime there's a conflict between what two instructions do. So does this idea make sense? So we can correlate this to our CPU we saw earlier, and we can see that they changed a few names. So what I called the opcode on that diagram, they call iCode. That's the name they used. What I called dest, they called vowel capital C. And what I didn't name, which was plus the length of a knot, they called vowel P. So the names are a bit different, but it's the same thing we saw in the picture before, just written out. And the convention in the textbook is that they don't explicitly talk about the muxes, so the logic which tells us what the muxes do is not listed there. It's just implied because one's for a knot, one's for a jump, that you add muxes, so if it's a knot, it does the things in the knot column. If it's a jump, it does the things in the jump column. Whenever, like here, there's two different values we want on the PC wire. So any questions about the correspondence between the listing and this picture? This listing. Okay. So another thing that comes up is that, well, we have to do other operations like reading and writing memory and reading and writing registers. So let's look at how our textbook represents that. So here we have an assignment from R of RA, and this means that we're reading from register number RA. So it means that when you're implementing this in HTLRS, you're sending the register number input, like reg source A or reg source B, to RA. And we're setting the output wires, we're calling those val A. So we're calling output A val A, is what they're telling us here. And there's a note that sometimes there's no corresponding read. We saw earlier that, you know, you don't have to read, that if you do an extra reads, we don't care as long as you don't use the. We also have assignments to memory. So in the memory stage, we have this thing saying 8 bytes at address val E becomes val A. And what we're saying is set the address input. So this is mem adder to val E, set the value input, mem input to val E A, and set write enable to 1, mem write bit to 1. That's what that notation tells us to do in HTLRS. And for a read, we set the address input mem adder to val E, and we set name the output val M, is what this tells us. And we also set mem read bit to 1. We also have a write. So the write here says we set the destination to RA, and we set the input corresponding to that destination to whatever val M is, that signal that we named earlier, which in this case is the output of the memory. And that because we're missing an assignment here, this is here, we're gonna set the register file write number equals OXF in the other case, in order to make it not happen. Because nothing there means we set the input to 15 to make sure the write doesn't do anything. So any questions about what was going on here, how what's on this listing corresponds to our actual HCL components? And I guess I would note that our write-up on HTLRS has a systematic listing of, like, here are the register file inputs and what they mean if you need to look them up, in addition to, like, referring to these slides when you're actually doing assignments. So one thing, is that our textbook's listings are doing something where they're only listing the parts which determine where data goes. So they aren't listing everything that I have highlighted in red here. All that stuff disappears. It's kind of implied just because we know that sometimes we have to do different columns of stuff. We have all this what we call control logic that's not in those descriptions of the instruction operation. And this is a common distinction you'll hear about when people talk about processors, that we have the data path, which is the signals that carry the actual data, versus the control path, which is the signals that control muxes and so on. And generally, our textbook is omitting the control path from its descriptions. It's kind of just implied because you know what instructions are supposed to do. But of course, when you write HCLRS, you're going to need to write the control path so the instructions actually do the right things, that they make the right choice of all the things the processor could potentially do. This is not a clear line. So for example, condition codes, they affect like what data moves into the PC, for example. And you'll find disagreement on whether the condition codes and the logic which uses them is part of the data path or the control path. And we're not going to resolve that question. But I note that we're going to have lots of drawings where I omit large parts of the control path. And this is because, gosh, this drawing is pretty busy and it gets worse. So here is my full, circuit for implementing the Seek processor. So we needed some extra things here, and let's think about what those were. So one question is, why do I need this? What is that for? Yeah.
For push and pop.
Push and pop. So you're saying push and pop. Operate RSP. So push, if you remember, it's instruction encoding. We have our I code for push, we have an F, and then we have the register we're pushing and an F. None of these values equals the register number of RSP, which means that RA and RB aren't RSP, and we have to read RSP in some way, right? Because we better read RSP to add or subtract to it, and also to read memory at that location. So we have to use it. So we need some way of getting RSP into source A, source B, or source A. And here I've arbitrarily chosen source B. You could choose source A. But I needed that value. And I chose source B because for pop, RA is the, for pop, RA is where we need to read from anyways. So that's the one that's spare. So there's other instructions besides push and pop which need that. Anyone think of them?
It's returning.
Return and call. Because they are basically push and pop, but do something a bit different. And all these instructions that need to read RSP, they also need to write RSP, and it's also not val A or val B, so they also need another RSP value that's sort of hard-coded as a mux input. Okay, so we have a few other things here. So what's this 8 for? Yeah, so this is RSP plus or minus 8. So we select add or subtract. And then we get RB in here. So this can sometimes be RSP's value on an ALUB input. And that's how we can add or subtract 8. Thank you. Okay, and what's this for? That sometimes we want to write PC plus 9 into the data memory. Call, yes. This is call return address. Because that's the instruction after call, we need to store that in memory to know where to go from. Okay. So I've gone over sort of all the signals we have here. And not all of them, but many of them. So we added a few extra because mux choices because we had more things we needed to decide between. Like we learned that reading from RA and RB didn't always work. Push and pop had this special case where we RA and RB wasn't enough to implement the instruction, and so on. So with this processor here, let's start with here. So I have all these muxes here. I have one in front of the PC, I have one in front of DESTM, one in front of DESTD, one in front of the ALU, another in front of the ALU. I've chosen to have a zero here. We'll figure out if we need that. And I have one in front of the data memory input. The data memory input, and so on. So, tell me, and also this mux here, the data memory address. So when we're running add, what should these muxes select? So I'll go through all of them. I was just writing down. Make sure you can tell me what all the muxes should select on this picture.
Memory address.
Okay, anyone, who needs more time? Okay, who can tell me any one of the muxes? Anyone, we'll start there.
For destination E.
Okay. For destination E, which is here.
Oh yeah, that should be wired to RB.
Okay, so it should be the RB input, which is the top one. And so this is gonna be RB, which is equal to 9. So you're right to register 9. That seems fine.
Does desktop get set to 0?
And if we're doing that, we don't want to write two registers, so yes, we're going to set destem to 0xf, so we don't write using that other signal. Yeah?
We have destem set to RB and destem.
The question is, could we set destem to RB? So that seems like a sensible idea. The problem is that we need this the destem's value input to actually be the result of the addition. And to do that, we would need to add an extra wire, add an extra mux in front of here.
Okay.
So you could do that, but we need a different set of muxes. Yeah?
ALU A should be outputting from the register source A.
Okay, so the ALU A should come from the register source A. It shouldn't come from the immediate. Any other? Still have a whole bunch of other muxes here, yes? Yeah, we don't want to add 0. Come from source B, okay. How about any more muxes we care about? Yeah. What should be, sorry? PC should be the lowest one. We want to add the instruction length. We don't want to use the immediate as the new part of the instruction memory output as the new value, like an immediate. We don't want to use data memory as a new value. PC? Okay, there's still a few more that. There, yeah.
The data memory and.
Yeah. So this and this don't matter because here we're doing, not read or write. We're inputting, we're setting read bit and write bit to 0, so we're not reading or writing, so it doesn't matter what we do with those muxes, we can do whatever.
When you're adding, aren't you writing into R9?
Question is, aren't we writing into R9? Yes, and happily we've set Desti's input is equal to R9. And our next RDSD, this is hardwired to the ALU, so this is going to be equal to R8 plus something. Plus something. It comes from the register. But yeah.
So the data in and data out is only from memory, not from
the register. This is, sorry, yes. So your confusion, this is the ALU here, this is the data memory. Yeah. In this picture, dest E, because this is where this wire goes. We could make it dest M, but then we need an add a mux to make that happen, which we could do, would be perfectly fine to do, but that's not what this picture has done. So there's one mux that we actually need to set that I haven't drawn on, that is actually pretty important, yeah. Yes, we don't want to read from the stack pointer. So we connect source B to RB, and now we're actually adding R8 and R9. And I believe this is everything we need for this instruction. Okay. Any questions about any of these? Yeah. R8 is sent to source A, yes. I have the annotated version here, if that helps. Other questions? Yeah. Just to remind us what the top input is that we're not selecting. Yeah.
For the program count of months, when would you ever take the middle one?
When will we take the middle one? We'll get there. We'll go through enough instructions. I think we have the time that we'll eventually get to that one. Other questions? And if not, ask me next time. Okay, so let's, I don't think I have a slide prepared for this one, but let's say instead of this, we're doing IR move Q of 1 into R9. How would the muxes be set for an IR move Q? Anyone can tell me one thing that needs to be happen for the muxes for IR move Q? So we're doing IR move Q 1 into, in this case, we'll say R9. Yeah? So destem is set to 0xf because you've concluded that, this has to come from the data memory. We're not going to read the immediate value, okay? From memory. Okay, that seems fine. Any other things we need to set? Yeah. Dest D is going to be R9, which happily is going to be RB. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
ALUA takes in the immediate.
Takes in the immediate. So we're going to take the immediate in ALUA. Sounds fine. Yeah.
Data in.
Data in. We don't care because we're not using the data memory. This is read bit equals write bit equals 0. Okay. Yeah. ALUB is 0. We finally have a use for this 0. And that we can just add the immediate and 0 and do that. And this is what the textbook does. So the textbook decides everything always goes through the ALU for value. So we're going to add 0 to do IR move Q. If you wanted to, because you could instead draw a different processor and do something where you add a mux here and just make a little shortcut instead. That would be fine, but that's not what this picture has done. And that's not what the textbook has done, but you can implement either when you're building your processor. And, great. Are there any other things that we actually care about that we need to set here? I can see at least one that's relevant for IR move Q. And it's on the list of muxes, in fact. Yeah?
The TC needs to become the TC plus the instruction, right?
Yeah, we need to set the PC correctly. Okay. So any questions about IR move Q here? And now you see what that 0 was for, and that there's this alternative which doesn't use it, and if you want to do that, that's fine, and that's a very reasonable thing to do, to not add 0 when you could just have a bypass. Okay, no questions on this. So let's take another example, which is R move Q. And we've seen this one. So if someone wants to start, what happens for R move Q? So any? Any, just one of the muxes, yeah. Yes, so people are finally starting with the easy ones. So the program counter is the easy one. There we go. So the program counter is the easy one. How about another one? Yeah. MME are set to 0xf, yes. We don't want to write to the register file. Anything else?
Data in.
Yeah, so data in, we're not going to write PC plus 9. It's not a call. We're going to write from the register output A. Yeah. ALUB is going to be, you say, equal to 0. Okay, so why would we do that? What's that preparing for? So let's remember what an RM move queue looks like. So we have RM move queue from say R8 to D on say R9. So I have a different opinion on what ALUB. The source B. Yes. Yeah?
And ALUA is connected to the first one?
To the immediate, yeah. Because we're going to do D plus R9, and that's exactly what we're going to compute in the ALU now. We're going to set up the ALU to do that computation. So how about another mux which needs to be set? You might look at that we just did that and decide we want to use the value. Yes.
For the address N, we need to set it to the result of the ALU.
Yeah, we set it to the result of the ALU. And I think that's everything here. Questions on this? And let's do call. Call is a bit more complicated, maybe. Yeah.
What do we use specification M for if we don't use it for writing?
We use it for writing, so it's connected to the data memory. So in this picture, anytime you want to read a value from memory and write it to a register, we have to use destination M. Because that's the only way we can get a value from memory into the register file. So what do we do for call? Yeah. So PC plus 9. We're going to use this value. We're going to write it to memory. So yeah. So source B is RSB because we know we need to write it to the stack. So we need the stack pointer. That's the only way in this picture to get the stack pointer. Okay. Yeah.
For the data memory address input, it's going to be R source P.
So the data memory's address input, you say it's going to be R source P. So we're going to write to, so you want this to be there. So we're going to write to the current location of the stack pointer then.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so yeah. That's not what we want to do. We want to actually write, compute the location, and since we're at basically out of time, and we want to add 8 to the stack pointer. So someone asked about what was, I believe, this signal used for here, and that's return. So return is the case where we actually need to take RB directly, or pop, because we want to write to RSP, but compute RSP plus 8. We want to read from RSP and compute RSP plus 8. And that's where we actually use that extra mux input there. Okay. And So next time we'll review this and then move on to pipelining.